Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, and along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab, and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Madawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocqueville, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Desert, bear, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. Thank you for getting us on the show tonight in flawless shape. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, listening to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. Audrey, didn't you think that Johnny Cash wanted to sing a little bit longer tonight? He went, he went a couple bars longer than normal. We only let him go to Dayton, Ohio, normally, but he just kept going tonight. A natural urge, probably. Anyway, thank you very much for getting us on the show, and he does sing a beautiful song. Remember, that covers 90 different cities and states across the United States, and one of these nights we are going to let him do the entire song, which would be marvelous. Mike and Emily, thanks for you being in the room tonight, and you're going to do a little news work for us tonight, aren't you, Mike? Emily, too. That's right. Okay, well, thank you very much. We'll get to that in just a few moments. Ladies and gentlemen, our show is what it's always about. We like to discuss the news issues and events and developments and the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice in the field of criminal justice. We have a news story tonight that's not exactly so humorous, but I don't. What, Emily, you said would be cute. All right, it's in the category of cute. We'll get to that one in just a moment. But it's sort of an odd thing that normally you wouldn't hear about, and something I didn't know that we did to police canine dogs. Our show is dedicated to the tireless police force, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and, indeed, throughout the world. And we try to look inside the criminal justice field here every week after week, and look at the criminal justice practice, and we enjoy doing that each week. And tonight is going to be a very special treat. If you didn't happen to look at the billing on the show website tonight, it's something, it's truly unusual. We have a mix of a couple phenomena that I think you're going to really enjoy. Blog Talk Radio is this leading-edge technology that now hosts as many as 60,000 shows. I believe I saw on the website or one of the newsletters they sent to me. It's broken up into about 66 different genres, and this has happened in just from one show about 18 months ago to the point now where the internet is flooded with Blog Talk Radio shows. If you haven't had a chance to go to the Blog Talk Radio Network and look at some of those shows, you should really, really do that. And this is all a tribute to Alan Levy and his crew. Alan is the CEO of the Blog Talk Radio Network. And what is possible, which I try to make clear week after week, every week, is that any person in the interest group, any organization, may have their own show, and they can broadcast worldwide in streaming audio over the Internet, and you can do that to an unlimited number of listeners. So if you're interested in homicide or volleyball, certain genre of music or whatever it is, you can have a radio show. And each week, as I actually each every other day perhaps, as I look at the Blog Talk Radio Network, I'm absolutely astounded at the number of celebrities that either have their own show on there or, in fact, are guests on other people's shows. So there's some very, very popular shows. Some, I think, broadcast as much as 5-6 days a week. And you can get on there and take a look and see who all those people are. You'll enjoy it. So get your own show is what I always say. Had a little buzz there on my phone here, which is something kind of unusual. But tonight, let me tell you what we're going to do. As usual, we'll have the In the News segment of our news, and there is some really big news story. New York Times released an early release of it this afternoon. Couldn't even wait till tomorrow morning. And we'll take a look at that particular news about imprisonment in the United States. And it certainly has some interesting things to say about what's going on. And there are at least several interpretations of the story, and I'll certainly not hold back on giving you mine. But we'll have listener calls if somebody chooses to call in tonight. But normally when they see we're going to do sort of a rebroadcast of an old show, folks don't do that. But this is tonight we're going to do something. Remember Jack Webb of Drill Instructor fame, the movie, and, of course, of Dragnet fame? Jack Webb also starred in some old murder mysteries, and we've played one or two of those for the last year and a half. And we're going to do another one tonight, and the one tonight is called Little Jake, and it was part of a murder mystery series that only lasted 5 segments. The setting is in 1924, and it's part of a series called Pete Kelly's Blues. And Jack Webb, of all things, doesn't exactly play a detective. He plays a musician and a cornet player in a blues band. So throughout this show, it's about a 30-minute show, you're going to see Jack Webb and hear him talk about blues music, and of course allegedly played by Jack Webb, but at least he's the actor that plays the part. So I think you'll really enjoy that. What folks do on this is you kind of listen to this on your Windows Media computer and or Windows Media Player on the computer, or you can call in if you choose to do that. You can listen to the entire show on your cell phone, and we can talk to as many as 5 people that call into the show at the same time. If you can't hear a particular show or you want to know what we did a week or so ago or 6 months ago, you can actually go back to the Blog Talk Radio site, the Jumbled Justice site in particular, and you can go back and get every show that we ever did. And I think tonight we're around number 76 or number 77. And by next week we'll know more about that because I'm going to give you some information based on some data I gathered about this show and a little more general information about the Blog Talk Radio Network. I'm writing a paper about it, and I'm in the process of wrapping that up. That's an exaggeration. I'm about halfway through, but I'll have it done by next week. So, Audrey, you all set tonight with your blonde joke? For those who might be a first-time listener, let me tell you that Audrey is a blonde. She's been a collector of blonde jokes since she was a little child. And she loves these things, and we've come to enjoy them over the last year and a half also. And so she's got one for us tonight. And Audrey, what is this one about? I can't remember. What's this one about? Oh, it's about time. Okay, I know. I remember this one. Thank you.
Professor Haley, this is a short blonde joke for tonight. Well, I mean a short joke, not a short blonde as the subject of the joke. Stop smiling, Mike, before I spill you coffee. Just kidding. Here is the joke. A blonde asked someone what time it was, and they told her it was 4:45. The blonde, with a puzzled look on her face, replied, you know, it's the weirdest thing. I have been asking that question all day, and each time I get a different answer.
All right, short but funny. That's a good one. And ladies and gentlemen, we segue right over to an important public service announcement. The Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence has made a public service announcement, and I think it's directed toward the gang members and gang bangers and criminals on the streets of the state of Ohio. But we very much appreciate the message that they're playing, and I hope that the criminals and junior criminals in the state of Ohio hear this. They will, in fact, lay their guns down and cause no more harm. But here's their public service announcement.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. And again, it is a very deadly idea. And I'm sure that some, at least, will pay attention to that message and lay down their guns, turn them into the police, even if the police don't offer any type of reward or incentive for doing that. Well, let's go ahead and take a look at the news tonight, and I'm going to get some help here from Emily, Mike, and Audrey. Got some interesting things to look at. This first one, Emily, you're going to do the first one for us. It's kind of an interesting little story, and you know, I had no idea that canines wore shoes. Go ahead and tell us about this one.
German police dogs get shoes for Paw Patrol. Monday the 26th of February 2008, 16:01 GMT. Police dogs in the German city of Düsseldorf are being fitted out with new rubber shoes to protect their paws while walking the beach. The dogs aren't simply yet, but with a few weeks training they should be used to them, Andre Hartwich, a spokesman for police in the Western city, said on Monday. Hartwich said shards of glass and sharp objects get stuck between the cobbles of Düsseldorf's old town and are dangerous for the K-9 squad. The shoes will protect their paws on patrol, he said.
Well, that's good that they do that. Very interesting.
The German shepherds are being taught to walk and work with their new footwear in time for a police fashion show in March. The blue synthetic rubber shoes, modeled on a design made for sled-pulling Canadian Husky, will cost about €16, £11, he said.
I wonder if they're Italian shoes. You know, as you know, Italy and Romania is part of the EU, then they could get access to some really fine Mercantini Fiorentini leather shoes, perhaps. We'll have to see what those things are like. Here's another kind of odd story. We do a lot of different things to keep juvenile pests away from business owners. I actually know of a person here years ago whose business was ruined by people who gathered out in front of it and never bought a thing. And he ran a fine pizza store just north of Cincinnati, and it became a gathering spot for people to load up in town and take off to his place and hang out till all hours of the night. And I actually had him into a class once to speak about this experience. And essentially, the police in that community didn't do much about it. But here's a solution that they're going to try in London.
Stores new sonic devices to chase kids. February 12th, 8:26 a.m. by Robert Barr, London and Glen's Commissioner for Children and the Civil Liberties Group joined in on a campaign Tuesday to ban high-frequency devices intended to drive misbehaving children away from shops and other areas. The so-called mosquito device emits high-frequency noise, which is audible and annoying to young ears, but generally not heard by people over 20.
Why would you want to stop that? Go ahead.
The device is a quick fix that does not tackle the root cause of the problem, and it is indiscriminate, English Children's Commissioner Elaine Smeet-Green said. The campaigners claim that about 3,500 of the devices made by a Welsh company are in use. Ainsley Green said in an interview with British Broadcasting Corp. Radio that the devices do not tackle the real problem, which is that children have no place to gather other than on the streets. I think it is a powerful symptom of what I call the malaise at the heart of our society, he said.
Hmm.
I'm very concerned about what I see to be an emerging gap between the young and the old, the fears, the intolerance, even the hatred of the older generation toward the young. Shami Chakrabarty, director of the civil rights group Liberty, supported the campaign.
I'm trying to think, Mike, what's new about that? Go ahead.
Imagine the outcry if the device was introduced that caused blanket discomfort to people of one race or gender, rather than to our kids, Chakrabarty said. The mosquito has no place in a country that values its children and seeks to instill them with dignity and respect. The mosquito's inventor, Howard Stapleton, has called for agreement about guidelines for using the devices.
I think the emphasis there should be on a nation that instills dignity and respect if they're out causing problems out in front of somebody's businesses. Maybe something's gone wrong there.
Tell shopkeepers to use it when they have a problem. And I would be more than happy to introduce a contract which stipulates for shopkeepers how it can be used. Stapleton was quoted as telling the Western Mail newspaper. People talk about infringing human rights, but what about the human rights of the shopkeeper who is seeing his business collapse because groups of unruly teenagers are driving away his customers?
February 28, 2000.
I'm glad someone thought of that. That's good. I mean, the shop owner should have some kinds of rights, and again, that's precisely what happened to my friend Sandy, just north of Cincinnati. So, anyway, here's a very interesting story. Audrey, I guess you're going to do this one for us. And this is one that came out this afternoon in the New York Times, and there'll be so many interpretations of this. And one of the things that's happened here, this is the Pew Research Center. They did a little switch on what normally happens in terms of computing crime and incarceration rates. And I'll comment on that after we get started here.
February 28, 2008, 1 in 100 U.S. adults behind bars, new study says by Adam Liptak. For the first time in the nation's history, more than 1 in 100 American adults is behind bars, according to a new report. Nationwide.
Emily, I do want to say I know that you're not Audrey. you folks switch stories there, but go ahead.
The Britain population grew by 25,000 last year, bringing it to almost 1.6 million. Another 723,000 people are in local jails. The number of American adults is about 230 million, meaning that one in every 99.1 adults is behind bars.
Now, I guess one of the first things we can ask is, what should our reaction be to this? Because we know that we're experiencing the lowest crime rates we've had in about 50, in fact, more than 50 years. So I'm not sure that we should get terribly excited about this. Of course, there are some other perspectives. So what are we saying? So one in about 100 adults are actually in the penitentiary. And it'll come out later in the article, but normally the way we compute the crime rate is the number of crimes over the population, then multiply that times 100,000, and we include in that category, of course, children. You know, four-year-olds aren't being arrested for felonies, for example. We've always used that as the standard way of computing crime rates, incarceration rates, or whatever. So what the Pew Research Center here has done is only taken adult people. So, of course, the effect there would be what? We'd have a higher incapacitation rate or imprisonment rate and a higher crime rate in general. So there's a little trick there. I suppose there's some logic in using that statistic, but why would we want to vary from the one we've been using since the late 1920s?
Incarceration rates are even higher for some groups. One in 36 Hispanic adults is behind bars, based on Justice Department figures for 2006. One in 15 black adults is two, as is one in nine black men between the ages of 20 and 34. The report from the Pew Center on the state also found that only one in 355 white women between the ages of 35 and 39 are behind bars, but that one in 100 black women are. The report's methodology differed from that used by the Justice Department, which calculates the
Now, let's go back there a minute. One of the things we could say about that is, one in 36 Hispanic adults are behind bars. One in 15 black adults is behind bars, as to one in 9 black men in the age of 20 to 34 is behind bars. And that's a high statistic, and it's an abominable statistic, and I suppose one we should be ashamed of. But in fact, we've studied this backwards and forwards. You don't go to prison for doing nothing. Let's include probably some sentencing disparity somewhere, but not everywhere. Depends who you read on that. It's the crime rates are simply higher in the categories of some people in the United States. And, of course, we're a nation that's obsessed by parcelizing people out into race, age, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera. But it says there that 355 white women, only one in 355 between the ages of 35 and 39 are behind bars, and that's substantially different, for black women. But one of the things there I used to always say in my criminology class, if you want to really reduce crime, I know two ways, but I can't get anybody to go along with it. The two most prominent characteristics associated with crime in the United States is youthfulness, in other words, age, and maleness, being a male. So if we could find some type of pill that would advance the age of our young crime-prone males up to the age of 25, all of a sudden zip them up to about 50, and then if we could get a whole bunch of them to engage in the sex change, then we'd have older females, and our crime rate would almost drop off the page. We wouldn't have any crime. But here's some more data that's kind of interesting.
Incarceration rate by using the total population rather than the adult population as a denominator. Using the department's methodology, about 1 in 130 Americans is behind bars. Either way, said Susan Ewan, the center's managing director, we aren't really getting the return in public safety from this level of incarceration.
What?
But Paul Cattle, a law professor at the University of Utah and a former federal judge, said the Pew report considered only half of the cost-benefit equation and overlooked the very tangible benefits lower crime rates.
Yes, I can imagine. Lower crime rates is what it's all about. And it took us from about 1965, when crime rates shot up to astronomical rates in the 1980s and then inched up again until 1991 or 92, we couldn't figure out that locking up the bad guys did anything. In fact, we had a lot of our top writers and commentators in the criminal justice criminology field particularly saying that locking people up would have no effect on crime rates. And can we say that, in fact, we know that locking people up does have an effect on crime rates? Now, there's more to it than that. They're in prison. Eventually, 97-98% of them are going to get out. That's another matter, but you can't argue with the crime data today. Go ahead, Emily.
In the past 20 years, according to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, violent crime rates fell by 25% to 464 for every 100,000 people in 2007 from 612.5 in 1987. Although we certainly want to be smart about who we put into prison, Professor Cattle said it would be a mistake to think that we can release any significant number of prisoners without increasing crime rates. One out of every 100 adults is behind bars because one out of every 100 adults has committed a serious criminal offense.
Thank you, Professor Castle. I'm glad someone points that out, and sometimes I'm almost surprised the New York Times would print that or even get him as a commentator. But as soon as we get the prisons full, the next thing we start talking about is letting people out and shortening the sentences. And I've always told folks in the classroom and others that I discuss this with that sentencing is the biggest shell game in the world. You and I were never intended to understand it. And as soon as we do, the nature of the game changes. It's a very complicated subject, and the arguments are never over about sentencing disparity and discretion of judges. And we've had decisions here the United States Supreme Court in the last 3 or 4 years that deal with judges' discretion and sentencing guidelines and all of that business. So what else is in that article, Emily?
Doing said the nation cannot afford the incarceration rate documented in the report. We tend to be a country in which incarceration is an easy response to crime, she said. Being tough on crime is an easy position to take, particularly if you have the money. And we did have the money in the 80s and 90s. Now, with fewer resources available, the report said prison costs are blowing a hole in state budgets. On average, states spend almost 7% on their budgets on corrections, trailing only healthcare, education, and transportation.
Of course, if we didn't spend it on corrections, we'd spend it on something else, but if people were given a choice, most of them would choose not to be hit on the head or robbed or have their home broken into. That's a fairly wise choice in terms of our spending. At least most citizens would think that, and we know that from national polling data over the last 30 or 40 years.
In 2007, according to the National Association of State Budgeting Officers, states spent $44 billion in tax dollars on corrections. That is up from $10.6 billion in 1987, a 127% increase one suggested for inflation. With money from bonds and the federal government included, total state spending on corrections last year was $49 billion. By 2011, the report said, states are on track to spend an additional $25 billion. It costs an average of $23,876 to imprison someone in 2005, the most recent year for which data were available. But state spending varies widely, from $45,000 a year in Rhode Island to $13,000 in Louisiana.
Well, that's interesting. I used to, for years, Arkansas had one of the lowest costs of incarceration, and I see Louisiana's way down there. And your chances, by the way, most incapacitation data will show that Louisiana is number one in the country in terms of the per capita people serving time in prison. But $45,000 a year in Rhode Island, I thought that Minnesota and some other states had a higher figure than that. But we'll take this as gospel without any conflicting information at this point.
The cost of medical care is growing by 10%
annually. That's a big one.
The report said, and will accelerate as the prison population ages. About 1 in 9 state government employees work in corrections, and some states are finding it hard to fill those jobs. California spent more than $500 million on overtime alone in 2006. The number of prisoners in California dropped by 4,000 last year, making Texas's prison system the nation's largest, at about 172,000. But the Texas legislature last year approved broad changes to the Corrections System Act, including expansions of drug treatment programs and drug courts and revisions to parole practices.
When I lived in Texas, was incarcerating very few people, at least for a long period of time. And I've mentioned, I think, on previous shows that in 1991 or 92, Texas prisoners were serving about 22 days on a year. So if they went to prison for 2 years required, they didn't even spend 2 full months in prison. And then, of course, when they got out, recidivism as it is, at least over half the inmates go out and commit more crimes that they get caught for. Get caught for may be another clue in terms of understanding these data, but Texas got really mad about it, started building up the prisons, and Governor Ann Richards was governor at that time, and she oversaw some of the prison expansion, but she also had the largest drug treatment programs in the world. All the prisons had these drug treatment. In fact, some prisons are actually called drug treatment prisons, and that's unusual. And it was a good idea, and I think they probably experienced some success with it. And when George Bush became governor of Texas, he took the names off of those prisons, but kept a lot of the drug treatment programs. And, everything in Texas is bigger, right? Well, now we know with their 172,000 in prison, once again, they're the largest prison system in the United States. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think what we're going to go ahead and do is go ahead and take a look at our show for tonight. And this is a radio rebroadcast of a show called Little Jake, is the name of the particular segment, that was part of a mystery series that lasted only five shows, I believe. But the star of this particular show was Jack Webb. And Jack Webb plays a blues musician. And the setting is 1924. And if you like blues music, you're going to hear it in the back, at least a version of blues music. You'll be hearing it in the background and sometimes up front in the story. So let's go ahead and try to enjoy Pete Kelly's Blues. The exact segment is entitled Little Jake.
This one's about Pete Kelly. It's about the world he goes around in. It's about the big music and the big trouble and the big 20s. So when they ask you, tell them this one's about the blues. Pete Kelly's Blues. Pete Kelly's Blues, starring Jack Webb, with story by Jim Moser and music by Dick Cathcart. Find us at 417 Cherry Street, Kansas City. It's a standard speakeasy. We've got 35 cases of cut whiskey and a 7-piece band. We start every night at 10 and we play till 6 in the morning. Not much, but the contract runs out in June 1924. After that, there's a place in South Chicago that may take it. In the meantime, we're working here on Cherry Street. The lease is made out to George Lupo. His brother gave it to him after the funeral. The kind of music we play started out as a backroom exercise in a little swamp stop called Myrtle Grove. La Rocca took his Dixieland band to Reisenweber's in New York. We got as far as Kansas City. It's no place to get off a train unless you're a Sacramento. Because around here, everybody works at the same job, staying alive. Half a buck buys a pair of socks, a spaghetti dinner, or a down payment on murder. Well, last night, everything turned sour about midnight. The town was down on its hands and knees trying to crawl through one of those Kansas City hot spells that blast by every third day. It was heat and headaches all the way. Our drummer Nick was dragging the beat and I went bad 12 bars in on the Memphis Blues. Well, I figured we better cut the set short, so we started to fight our way through one chorus of Roses of Picardy. That's when the kid came in and stood to the bandstand. He was tall enough to see over a quart of milk with a face the size of a minute and about as young. Let's get off for a while.
Who's your friend, Pete?
I don't know, but he must be tone deaf.
Mr. Kelly! Mr. Kelly!
Yeah, son?
I heard you play. You sound good.
We've been better. What's on your mind?
Father Cronin sent me to see you.
Are you doing a little missionary work?
Oh, no, sir, nothing like that. I'm an altar boy over there. Father calls me Little Jake.
I sure got you working the late shift.
I've been trying to get a hold of you all day. Father wants a favor.
Well, make it a small one. I'm all out of the pocket.
He just wanted to know if you could come by St. Timothy's and see him. He said tomorrow morning right after the 9 o'clock.
Okay. Tell him he keeps terrible hours. I'll be there.
Thanks, Mr. Kelly.
He's killing
me. Yeah, that's right.
Tell the kid goodbye.
He knows his way out.
Should I go, Mr. Kelly?
Be the kid.
Yes, sir. Goodbye, Mr. Kelly.
Yeah, goodbye, Jake.
You got someplace private we'd like to talk?
This is my office.
Now, listen hard, bright eyes. There's enough gun in this coat to blow you right through the wall.
I'll take your word for it.
We come in nice and you get funny mouth.
Now, you got someplace we can talk?
I can't leave. I got to do a number.
Do it. I'll be right here about 10 feet from your stomach.
Yeah. All right. Let's go.
You look sick, Pete. What's the matter?
I feel fine. Who's sorry now? Everybody ready? Let's go. Thank you.
Now, let's go.
Yeah. Keep them going, Red.
How many shall we do, Pete?
If this works out, about 10 minutes worth. Let's go.
The alley will do. We need a favor, Kelly.
Yeah, there's a run on them tonight.
Give me the envelope, Dix.
Yeah.
You got an inside coat pocket, Kelly?
Come on, either throw up half the dice.
Hold him, Dick. Pull him up, Dick.
Come on. Up.
Yeah. Now, this is how. Here's an envelope that goes in your inside coat pocket, and it stays there until 6 o'clock tomorrow night. You don't open it. You don't mess with it.
What happens at 6 o'clock?
You'll be the first to know.
Inside, Lupo was blowing up a storm. Something about paying for a 7-piece band and only having 6. Well, it wasn't worth trying to get back on the stand. I got a cab and went up to my room. I tried to get to sleep. It was no good. I got up. I was sick to my stomach. After that, I went to sleep. The next morning, I made a pass at some breakfast and tried to look through the sports page. Harry Heilman got 4-5 against the Red Sox, but that's all I read. That envelope had me. People have been taken out in alleys before, and they've been worked over, usually to get something away from them, not to give it to them. No matter how I tried to put it together, it wouldn't come out. Thin or fat, it wouldn't slice. I had the envelope, and I had to wait till 6 o'clock. Well, I gave up on the coffee, and I started over to see Father Cronin. It was a little after 9:30 when I started up the steps of St. Timothy's. I figured Mass was almost over, so I hung around in the vestibule for a couple of minutes, trying to look like a part-time bell ringer.
Hi, Mr. Kelly.
Hello, Jake.
Father's back in the sacristy, Mr. Kelly. He said for me to show you the way.
They move it?
No, sir.
All right, Jake, show me the way.
This way, Mr. Kelly. Down this aisle.
Well, I guess I was too busy trying to act like I knew my way around. I paid attention to a fat, chunky little guy wearing a brown porcelain hat. He stood up in a back pew a couple of aisles over. The church was empty except for the three of us. Little Jake found out about it just before I did.
Mr. Kelly, that man back there.
All right, mister. I'll take that envelope.
Jake, get out.
Mr. Kelly, look out. Look out.
Kansas City, you learn early to look for trouble. Any place, any time. But this is the first time it caught up with me in the middle of a church. The last three shots were a waste of money. Jake went down like young wheat in a hailstorm. When I grabbed for him, I hit my head on the base of a marble pillar. I lost the edge right there. By the time I hit the street, he was gone. I guess I covered every alley and street in the neighborhood. But it was like trying to wash a pail of dirty water. I don't know how much later it was when I stopped for a minute in an empty doorway and tried to remember what I was chasing. Well, a siren was crying off somewhere in the distance, and I started back for the church. The coroner's wagon was just pulling away as I got there. I didn't see Father Cronin around, so I went back to the rectory and rang the bell. He came to the door and he searched, lady. He stood there for a minute just looking at me. Then he motioned me inside.
In here. Sit down.
The kid, Father, little Jake.
He's dead. You want a blow by blow?
Yeah, I know, Father. I was there.
Sure you were there. You're always there. I should have known better than to call you. I should have known it meant trouble.
Oh, wait a minute, Father. This wasn't my party.
I called you here today to ask you a favor, Pete.
Yeah, I know.
You don't know. It's too late now. We're going to have an altar boys picnic tomorrow at Washington Park. I wanted you to play a little music for us. We won't be going now, Pete. We got a funeral instead.
Yeah. What do you want me to say?
Don't say anything, Pete. If you've got any private fights, that's your business. But don't bring your beef into the church.
I never saw the guy before, Father.
Don't kid me. He didn't come in here to shoot little Jake.
Well, look, I know this is hard to understand.
You bet it's hard to understand. We've been over it before, but you ran with the same pack. You hung on to the same friends. You had it all figured out. Well, you figured this one, Pete. There's a 9-year-old boy on his way to the moor. He took a gangster's bullet that you earned. Now you go ahead. Figure it.
I got this envelope.
I don't want an explanation. Take your excuses and peddle them where you need them. The bootleggers and the gunmen. Take them to your crowd.
This envelope, Father. They shoved it in my pocket. I was out in the alley behind the club. Two guys. They worked me over. I didn't think they'd try anything like this.
Neither did little Jake.
All right, Father. I told you I was sorry.
Go on home.
Why don't you stop cutting at me and say a prayer for that kid?
I would, but I'm too busy praying for people like you.
Well, you couldn't blame him. How do you explain away a dead kid lying in front of an altar rail? All I could offer was a piece of an envelope in my coat pocket and a wild night in an alley. I started to walk back to my room. I tried to paste up some kind of an answer, but I got nothing. I was halfway home when the last breeze left town and went someplace to cool off. My clothes were soaking wet, and I decided to take a cab the rest of the way. I reached in my pocket, and all I had was 23 cents, so I kept walking. Sunday morning's the same in any town. Empty streets and everybody home trading the comic section and living off of Saturday night. You could live here all your life, and on Sunday morning, you just got in town. It was about noon when I got to my hotel. I went up to the second floor and unlocked my door. They were sitting on the bed. Their coats were off, and they'd hung them on a chair. The same two boys had given me the envelope last night.
A real hot room here, Kelly. You want to move off this court?
Yeah, next time I'll get twin beds.
Is everything all right with that envelope?
It made a murder, mister. You take it.
Put it back in your pocket.
Now get this, both of you. There's a lot of something wrong here. I've had my turn. You find yourself another fall guy. There's a lot of inside coat pockets in this town. Look for a new one.
We like yours, and that's where it's going to stay. Now, you don't listen good. Me and Dex put it out last night, and you didn't pick up on it. We got you on board, and we'll tell you when to get off.
6 o'clock, boy.
How long do you think this jag will last? Look, I'm cashing in. I've had enough.
What are you doing this morning, trying to pray your way out?
The priest wanted a favor.
I got it, Lon.
Yeah. Yeah, he's in. No, he's busy. From 2 to 5. Sure, come on up.
Benny.
You went for it, huh?
On his way up. We're going to stay a while, Kelly.
Well, there's only 3 chairs. I'll make it easy for you.
Stay put, mister.
No, he's your friend. I'm checking out.
First time you've been right.
Well, it happened so fast, I didn't even see his arm move. My knees buckled and I pitched forward. I don't know how long I laid there. When I opened my eyes, the afternoon sun was almost gone. What was left of it was bleeding through a rip in the blind. Well, I could hear somebody breathing hard like a fat man on a hot day. When I rolled over, I saw him. A tough prohibition agent by the name of Cage. The weather didn't make any difference to Cage. He always looked that way. His collar was wilted and it looked like Arrow's first try. His necktie was pulled down and the knot was twisted. The heat had worked him over so that the front of his shirt was splotchy and damp. Reminded you of a first grader's map of the world. He was sitting in a chair with his arms draped over the back and his head resting on his hands. He was smoking a Milo Violet, but it didn't help that much. His mouth was wound around a toothy grin, and he looked like a mountain lion who'd just eaten her young.
You can get up now, Keller. You made your point.
Yeah, sure. How long you been here?
Long enough to fill out your book and slip. You're going to jail, mister.
What for? Sleeping on the floor?
For the dead guy on the bed. Who is he?
I don't know. How'd he get there?
You put him there after you shot him. Now get your hat.
Look, prohibition's your racket. Dead bodies are out of your line.
Not when I find him in your room. Now let's go downtown. We'll both tell homicide. We'll find the details later.
Cage, you couldn't find yourself in a mirror. I didn't have anything to do with this, and you know it. I've been out for the last 3 hours. This happened after they slugged
me. Save it for the jury. All I know is I got a phone tip to check room 205. I come up here and I find you and a dead guy. That's all I need. You can dress it up fancy and make it look cute, but it still comes out.
There's enough liquor in this town to float it away, and you're wasting your time with a killing that's none of your business.
You're my business, big shot. Somebody put 2 pounds of lead in Benny's chest, and you're my pick.
Benny who?
Benny Davis. He worked for Mike Quinlan. You look pale.
Yeah, I'm just beginning to feel the squeeze. Mike Quinlan on one side and those 2 trigger men that you let walk out of here on the other.
You got it, and I'll be turning the handle.
Now, before you start worrying about your picture in the paper, you better turn up the 2 guys that were here with me.
That part of the same dream?
They gave me an envelope to hold for him. The price on it's going up for the minute. A 9-year-old kid died for it, and this guy here on the bed.
That's a good story. Do you write him down or just make him up?
Look, you got nothing on me, and I haven't got much time. I'm leaving you.
That's all right. I call downtown. The minute you hit the street, they'll pick you up.
In the meantime, you better come up with more than you got. They don't hang you in this state on a hunch.
I'm going to check this room over. I'll find all we need.
You couldn't find your head with both hands. Goodbye, Cage.
All right, you got till midnight, big shot, and then I'll be around.
Yeah.
I'll have it all set up. All we'll need is time to run the act.
Well, I could have used a cold shower, but with Cage there, I didn't have the room to dry off. I went down the hall and headed down the back stairs. I figured even if Cage was right about calling downtown, I might have an answer if I moved fast enough. The sun was on the downgrade, but it didn't make any difference. He'd done a good job all day, and the heat was boiling up out of the ground. If I was going to come out at all, I had to have some help. so I started to look for the only honest guy I know, an ex-bootlegger by the name of Barney Ricketts. The only bootlegger in the country that went broke in 1922. He drank himself out of business. I phoned 8 different places and tried 4. Nobody'd seen him. I was about ready to give up when I finally found him sitting in the middle of a bourbon fog in a little Spanish joint somewhere on the edge of the East Bottom. He was sitting at a back table trying his best to make time with a plaster bust of Queen Isabella.
Ah, Peasy, my boy, you're just in time. I'm not quite certain, but I think the young lady here has a friend.
I gotta talk to you, Barney.
If you're any good at all with Spanish, now is the time. I was positive she'd loosen up on this second bottle of wine, but no, she's utterly uncharitable, and I think she's a picture of a perfect boy.
Yeah, all right, Barney.
Since you're a member of the old Castilian school, there can be no excuse for the conduct she's exhibited.
Yeah.
Why, do you know I was even good enough to buy her 3 rounds of Portuguese brandy? Imported, mind you. But what do I get for my pain? Not even a civil thank you.
All right, listen to me, will you, Barney?
I've been sitting here in the most gentlemanly fashion, sipping this delicate nectar and trying vainly to keep the party going. But does she help? No! I've talked to her about politics, medicine, literature, Keats, Byron, Shelley, Faith Baldwin. I've even talked about the weather.
Barney, she's a statue.
Oh, a simple oversight, Petey. It could happen to anyone.
Now, look, I'm in trouble.
Of course you're in trouble. You'll always be in trouble because you're a child of adversity, a son of scorn. The fate spit in your eye and you try to retaliate, but the wind's always blowing in the wrong direction. You're a lost leaf in the mortal storm, Petey. You're a pebble shaking a tiny fist at the mountain. You'd like to fight for some strange, fantastic cause, wouldn't you? But you can't find anybody your size. Men are too small and the gods are too big. Petey, you're lost.
Are you all through now?
Yes. What kind of trouble?
A pair of bum murder raps. Somebody slugged me in my room and I woke up with a dead guy.
Dubious honor. You mentioned 2 murders.
One of them was an altar boy over at St. Timothy's. The other guy worked for Mike Quinlan.
The same Quinlan that controls most of the Canadian import here in town?
Yeah, that's him.
Time's short. Let's finish the brandy.
2 guys started all this at the club last night. Names are Ludd and Beck. Mean anything to you?
This'll all sound better with more brandy. You picked 2 of Quinlan's first strings. Ludd Sandell and Dex Porter, both killers.
Look, they gave me an envelope to hang on to. Now nose around. See if you can find out what it all means. The dead guy up in my room, his name's Benny Davis. See if you can find out where he fits in, will you?
It'd be a lot simpler if you just joined Quinlan's gang. Benny Davis holds a card in the same organization.
Well, how about Ludd and Dex? Any bad blood between them and
Davis? If there is, it doesn't show. They're closer than unborn peas.
You sure about that, Barney?
Police blotter can't be that wrong. Benny's sister will tell you the same thing.
Well, where do I find her?
Chelsea apartment. Beautiful girl, Petey. When you're my age, she'll disturb your memories.
All right, now get going, will you? See how close you can get to Quinlan's headquarters. Find out what you can about Ludd and Dex and Benny Davis. Maybe Quinlan's got him on a special job or something. Find out what it is, will you?
You find me in a temporary economic slump, Petey. I'll need carfare.
Yeah, well, that makes 2 of us. I'm broke. You'll have to do it on foot.
Oh, well, I have friends here. My credit's unlimited.
Well, hurry up, will you, Barney?
One moment. Alfonso, would you loan me $1.50?
Come on, let's go.
He's only bluffing. He won't shoot.
Well, Barney headed down toward Bale Street for Mike Quinlan's place, and I started cross town for the north end and the Chelsea apartment. I couldn't begin to work it out. If Dex and Ludd were such good friends with Benny Davis, why did they kill him? And if they didn't do it, who planted his body in my room and why? Well, I was running way late and there wasn't much time to catch up. I finally found the Chelsea apartments on the corner of Stocker and Bale with an old 3-story wooden frame. I checked the mailbox and Louise Davis was down for apartment 17. Well, inside, the hallway was dark and a couple of gas jets were smoking up the ceiling. There was a potted palm by the foot of the stairs and it looked like it was growing out of old gum wrappers and cigar butts. Apartment 17 was at the rear of the first floor. She answered the door and you could tell right away Barney was right. She was pretty and she had enough smile to last you for years.
Yes?
You Louise Davis?
That's right. I can do better for you. You're Pete Kelly of Here to Play.
Yeah, well, so far you're batting 1,000. Can I come in?
Yeah, sure. You didn't bring your band, so it must be a social call.
I'll make this short. It's about Benny.
What about him?
That's what I want to know. He's got a couple of friends. I got to know about him.
And he isn't that popular. You mean Ludd and Dex?
They'll do. They got trouble and they're cutting me in.
What kind of trouble?
No, I'm not sure. That's why I came to you.
I can't help you. They never tell me what they're doing.
Well, they gave me an envelope. They told me to hold it till 6 o'clock tonight.
You haven't got any problem. You'll know in an hour.
Yeah, well, maybe I'm tired. I want to know now. I'll take any leads you got.
They found out I told you this. They might not like it. They got some kind of a beef with Quinlan.
Does Mike know about it?
I wouldn't know. I just heard him talking one night. They're not happy with the money Quinlan gives him.
They got any plans?
I don't think we've got to talk about this. Let me get you a drink, huh?
Now, look, this is the last trip around for me, lady. I got to have everything you know.
You said something about an envelope, didn't you?
That's right.
You got it?
Right here.
If you open it, you'll understand everything.
Well, they gave it to me sealed. They want it back the same way.
If you want to be around to give it back, you'd better open it.
You got a guarantee, Andy?
All I know is the three of them are working on something big. I don't know what it is, but I heard some talk about an envelope. Your choice. If you ask for a lead, you got it.
Yeah, we'll hold hands when they cut me down. You got a letter opener?
Please, look out!
Well, it all happened faster than a Mexican divorce. Louise Davis was dead before the echo left the room. Well, I got to the window, but whoever did the shooting was gone. I grabbed the envelope, and on my way out, I took another look at her. There wasn't anything left but the smile. I cut through a couple of back lots and down an alley. I stopped in the doorway and opened the envelope. Inside was a handful of typewritten sheets. Looked like a lot of headache for five pieces of paper. And then the bell rang. Two of them were consignment slips for 8,000 gallons of high-grade Canadian whiskey. The other three slips were detailed breakdowns for a convoy of trucks. They showed special truck routes over the Canadian border into the States to miss the hijackers and the prohibition agents. They showed a day-by-day schedule for each truck on its trip down from the border. Well, it's not too tough to hijack a load of booze, but when you got it laid out right down to the time, the place, and how many bottles, like money in the bank. Well, I knew right then why the envelope meant so much to Ludden Dex. What I couldn't understand was where they got it. Why they gave it to me to hang on to. Well, maybe they were working for Quinlan, but why didn't he have the papers, and why weren't they all safe? Mike had a big one. Well, the questions were still piling up. It was an outside chance, but I couldn't stand still, so I crossed over to the Kansas side and headed down Boulder Road to Fat Annie's place. Maggie Jackson did two things good. She sang the blues better than the guy who wrote them, and she could pick up an idle rumor at 3 miles.
Hi, Pete.
Maggie, what do you know?
I knew you'd be here tonight. You always come in together. Trouble and Pete Kelly.
Yeah, I know. I never come around except when I need something.
As long as I have it to give, you got it. It's Mike Quinlan this time, ain't it?
Well, that's part of it. I'm in it up to my ears.
You got an envelope, I heard.
Yeah.
Mike Quinlan and some of his boys have been here about an hour ago. They tore the paper off the walls looking for you and Dex and Ludd.
Dex and Ludd?
Mike wants all three of you.
Yeah, anything else?
No. Barney Ricketts called for you.
Did he leave a number?
He's still waiting on the phone. I took the call. He said you'd end up here, so he just hung on.
Well, I'll get it right now.
Yeah, the boss is kind of mad. The phone's been tied up for 2 hours.
All right, thanks, Maggie.
Sure, and good luck, Pete.
Hello, Barney.
Ah, there you are, Petey.
That'll be $1.25 for another 3 minutes.
Yes, all right, operator. Alfonso, 5 more quarters. No, the quarters. Just a minute, Petey. Alfonso doesn't know the quarters from the house.
Yeah, well, hurry up. What's going on, Barney? Where are you?
Fort Madison, Iowa. I'm troubleshooting for you.
Well, what'd you find out?
It's a double cross. Mike Quinlan's involved in one of the biggest deals of his career, and Benny Davis, along with Dex and Ludd, stole the consignment papers.
Yeah, I know. That's what's in the envelope.
You better get them back to Quinlan. I understand he's been tearing up the town for them.
Well, what do I do about Dex and Ludd?
She might easily end up like Benny Davis. Because Ludd and Dex didn't want to split it 3 ways, so they killed him.
You sure about all this?
That's why I'm up here in Iowa.
No, I'll see you when you get back.
It's a gay, mad world, Petey. We drove 60 miles an hour all the way up.
Yeah?
Alfonso's drunk. He thinks the phone's a slot machine. He's waiting for the payoff.
Well, as soon as I hung up the phone, everything fell into place. I had one big worry, to get back to the club and unload those papers before Quinlan caught up with me. Well, almost everything made sense now, except the killing of Louise Davis, Benny's sister. It was easy to see why they dropped Benny along the way, but why his sister? How did she tie in? Well, on the way back to town, I mulled over a couple of possibilities, and I figured maybe I came up with the answer. I started back for town, and it was rough all the way. I kept thinking any minute I'd bump into Mike Quinlan, and I couldn't be sure that I'd lost Dex and Ludd. It was almost dark by the time I got back to the club. The band was waiting around for the Sunday rehearsal. They ran through one number, and then things got cloudy.
Now, Kelly.
You're early, Dex.
Close enough.
No, not for me. You said 6 o'clock.
Your horn's no match for this gun. Give me the envelope.
6 o'clock, Dex. All right. Let's try someday, sweetheart. Hand me that plunger, will you, Red? I'll give you the pickup.
Ha ha!
You can pack up. I'll see you at 10.
You gonna give me that envelope, or do I blow it out of your pocket?
The same way you handled Louise.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I think you do. You killed her, and you killed her brother.
You got it all figured out, haven't you,
Kelly? Wrong player's right, Dex. Don't turn around.
You got it wrong, Lud.
I don't think so. I never should have let you kill Benny. That should have been the tip-off, and that kid in the church and Benny's sister. You had to make a big try.
It was for me and you, Lud.
It won't wash. You're gonna die, Dex. Pick a spot to lay down.
Not in the back, Lud. You'd give me a better chance than that.
Would I?
Look out, Lud.
Like I said, Dex, pick a spot. Well, that wraps it up, Kelly.
You better sit down, Lud.
No, this will do. It won't be a long wait. I don't mind standing.
Suit yourself. 6 o'clock, Lud. Here's your envelope.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Hello, Pete.
Hi, Father.
Just going to stop by. I heard the gunshots and knew you'd be around.
Well, let me tell you again, Father. I'm sorry about Jake. I don't know what else to say. I'm just sorry.
I believe you. We'll have the funeral for little Jake tomorrow. Maybe you want to stop by.
Yeah. Some things never figure. A 9-year-old kid shot down. No reason for it. None in the world. 9-year-old kid.
It's done, Pete. Don't waste your pity on little Jake. He's got a big lead on both of us.
I don't get you, Father.
You and I should die as good as a 9-year-old.
Pete Kelly's Blues, starring Jack Whitten, with story by Jim Moser and music by Dick Jackson, scoring by Matty Medlock.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. What an interesting show and an interesting plot, actually, in that story. And this was a series that started in the 1950s or late 1940s, 1950s, and the setting was Kansas City, Missouri, in the year 1924, and Jack Webb did four of those stories. The series was called Pete Kelly's Blues. Well, Audrey's given me the signal already that it's time to sign off for tonight. So, folks, I hope you enjoyed the show. Tune in next week. And remember, in 2 weeks, we have Professor Michael Lewis coming on to talk about the homeless again. This is his second appearance, but he's got new data from Dallas, so we look forward to that. So we'll be meeting again, I'm sure.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.